Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
Welcome to the Daily Jungle. The first World Series in Dodger Stadium in nearly 30 years, and Clayton Kershaw and Justin Turner both went legend. And Steelers wide receiver Juju Smith-Schuster took over social yesterday when somebody ripped his bike and he managed to get it back and get over noted athlete Killa, Mia Khalifa. And Kevin Bieksa landed one of the all-time right hands in a hockey fight, going Superman on flyer Radko Gudas. We also had three excellent guests, all baseball. New Detroit Tigers manager Ron Gardenhire, MLB analyst and nine-time All-Star Gary Sheffield, and Houston Astros manager A.J. Hinch right before Game 2. Alvy, it's all yours. It has been a while since the LA Dodgers have been to the World Series. Now, that 29-year stretch isn't exactly in. Jerome Bettis is from Detroit, and Brady Quinn's sister is married to A.J. Hawk territory. But it is in that neighborhood. So when the wait was finally over, and the Dodgers had a chance to play in a World Series game for the first time in nearly three decades, they broke out a number of pieces of their history. Vin Scully was in the building. Sandy Koufax was in the clubhouse, chatting with Justin Turner after the game. And the incredible Rachel Robinson and her family handled the first pitch on the 45th anniversary of the passing of Jackie Robinson. And then they followed up those pieces of history with the latest piece of history. Clayton Kershaw working a 9-pitch, 1-2-3 first inning. So much for that idea of the heat affecting him, or the moment, or the big stage. Because neither of the triple-digit temps nor the pressure of three decades bothered him at all. And if Kershaw going 9 pitches in the top of the first was good, what Chris Taylor did to the very first pitch in the bottom of the first was even better.
He stays away from the strike zone. He likes to see other hitters pitch. And on the first pitch, Chris Taylor hits it out. Keuchel gave up 15 home runs during the regular season in 146 innings in one pitch.
Dodgers radio. This guy's incredible. Chris Taylor goes yard on the very first pitch that he sees in the World Series off of Cy Younger. Because, of course, he did. That's who that guy is. And at that moment, it seemed like the series could be over pretty quickly. Any normal person who had just done what Dallas Keuchel had done by getting rocked with a 700-foot bomb on the first pitch of the World Series would have been a little rattled, a little unsettled, probably melted down. But Dallas Keuchel is not normal. He set down the next three batters to end the inning, which was huge. Now, I'm not going to say that if he had given up any more runs in that first inning, the series would have been over, but getting rocked in the first inning of Game 1 is no way to start a World Series. And Keuchel did not do that. Not only did he not do that, but three innings later, top of the fourth, Alex Bregman did this.
This one's belted. Left field, sending Kike back. He'll look up. Gone! Ties it up. Alex Bregman with a line shot to left field. It's 1-1. What a bullet by Bregman.
Albuquerque's finest. He had some jungle karma, didn't he? Astros radio. So from a disastrous start to a tie game. And those are the Astros for you. They're not going to roll over. They didn't come this far to lay down. They're going to just keep grinding. Keep on keeping on. Unfortunately for them, they ran into another grinder. The ultimate grinder. Justin, Matthew, Turner. One on, two out, top of the sixth.
Here's a 1-2. He stays put. And a fly ball to left field. It's deep. Back at the wall. And it's gone! A 2-run home run! Marwin Gonzalez runs out of room. Turner runs around the bases, and the Dodgers take a 3-1 lead.
And Justin Turner does what he does. He does it again. This guy's absolutely amazing. He is so sharp. He is so clutch. And yes, he would tell you that he did not get all of that and that he did get some help from the weather.
If it's 10 degrees cooler, that's probably a routine fly ball left field.
Maybe. Except it wasn't 10 degrees cooler, so that wasn't a routine fly ball to left. Instead, it was just another clutch home run from the guy who can't stop hitting clutch home runs. And then after seven innings, Dave Roberts turns the game over to the Dodger bullpen, and that was it. Brandon Morrow, Kenley Jansen, thanks for coming. Game one to L.A. L.A. could not have gotten off to a better start, but do not think for a second that Houston is overwhelmed or panicking. They faced the worst possible scenario to start that game. They weathered that storm, and now they've got Justin Verlander going tonight. So that's not bad. That's not bad at all. In fact, it may not look good. LA is now three wins away from winning their first world championship in three decades. But if Justin Verlander goes in there and they get their split, then they've got the home field too. So they're not in a bad spot at all, and you know they're not going to roll over. AJ Hinch. AJ, it's so good to have you back. How are you?
Oh, I'm pumped to be on the show during the World Series as a participant. You know, it's good to talk to you. I'm in Southern California right now, even though it doesn't feel like it with the heat wave. But pretty cool experience for me.
AJ, it's a really cool experience for us to have you on this show during the World Series. I can't say how much I appreciate you making time for it and doing it. You know, you tweeted the other day that you never knew what it was like to be World Series bound before the season. So I'm curious, as a baseball man your entire life, what kind of emotions were you feeling before the start of last night's game?
You know, obviously a lot of satisfaction, and you feel like you accomplished something because, you know, there's this dream when you start your career or when you start the season. Like, hey, I want to get to the World Series. I want to win a World Series. I want to ring. And all that stuff becomes very real when you're actually playing for it. You know, so for us, you know, to be able to be here, you know, we're not just happy to be here. We had a tough game last night, but we want to bring a championship back to Houston. And it does bring an enormous satisfaction for me as a manager to bring a team to the World Series, a team that's worthy and a team that has a chance to win it all. In my baseball career, I've never been happier.
Astros manager AJ Hinch joining us. So you have all that going for you, and it's right there. And then Dallas Keuchel gives up a home run on the very first pitch of the game. AJ, you know what? It seems to me a lot of guys in that situation could very well melt down given what happened and the stage that he was on. But this guy goes right back to work. What was your reaction when you saw the home run, and then what'd you make of how he responded?
Yeah, I mean, obviously the place went crazy, and the first pitch of the bottom of the first, it sort of, you know, it got the crowd into it, and it was, you know, it was obviously a tough start for us, and to watch him gather himself and kind of get back into it was really cool because he's a tremendous competitor, Cy Young Award winner a couple of years ago, and has really pitched well for us down the stretch, and it didn't surprise me he could sort of collect himself, and the moment I felt pretty good about it is he goes through the inning, he gets the next three hitters out. He comes off the field and he's on the top step and he's like, well, that didn't start very well for us, did it? So he was balanced and under control, and he really was locked in, and you know, one walk to Taylor later in the game and a homer by Turner, and we lose 3-1, but Dallas pitched tremendous.
AJ Hinch joining us. So he doesn't panic, really nobody else did. And speaking of guys who don't, Alex Bregman homered last night. And I love this guy's game. I love his attitude. Because there aren't too many guys who have more confidence than him. What's it like to manage Bregman, and what do you make of his approach?
Yeah, no, he's a real dude in this game. And you know, as a young player, he believes in himself more than anybody else needs to believe in him. And you know, I love how he plays with, you know, a chip on his shoulder, an edge to him. You know, we have this little banter back and forth that I want him to be the best third baseman on the, you know, in the competition, and he responds. And you know, as a throwback type player who's a grinder and is connected to every part of our clubhouse, he's garnered a lot of respect in our clubhouse about how he plays and he gets after it. And you know, you wouldn't know that, you know, he's the second pick overall for a reason. That's because of his ability, but his makeup is off the charts to the point to where he can, you know, he can really impact players. I mean, when you're a young player and you come up to the big leagues, you know, you're supposed to blend in and be quiet and sit in your locker and watch the veterans play. But to a man, whether it's Beltran or McCann or Altuve or Springer, I mean, these dudes respond to Bregman's edge. And you know, it's why he's in our lineup every day. He's the real deal when it comes to strapping it on and competing.
You know, AJ, that whole concept of makeup, and especially his makeup, how much of that is, like, teachable or coachable? And then how much of that is that guy just wired that way and he's always been that way?
Yeah, I think it's they start out being wired that way, and then you have to bring it out of them as a coach or as a manager just to allow them to be themselves and have them channel it in the right direction. You know, you can get a little outside yourself too. I mean, the good makeup guys that want it so badly can go a little bit too hard and get a little bit too crazy about it. But you know, they're wired that way from the beginning, and I think you coach it out of them or how to use it in the best way possible. So it's, you know, I think in a lot of ways you can't harness these guys too much. I mean, it's okay for them to be excitable. It's okay for them to have energy. It's okay for them to have a little skip in their step whenever, you know, a little trash talk here and there. I mean, if that's their MO, you've got to let them be themselves if you want them to be the best version of themselves. And Bregman, you know, among all this group, is probably the nastiest competitor along with Josh Reddick to really, you know, dig in the batter's box, look out at Clayton Kershaw, and he's like, I'm not sure which pitch I'm going to hit, but I'm going to hit one of them.
A.J. Hinch, Astros manager, joining us before Game 2 tonight in the World Series. So you've got Justin Verlander going tonight. He's been absolutely incredible since coming over in that trade. When you're looking at a guy who is 9-0 since joining you and you see the way he's throwing, how much confidence do you have that he's going to take that rock and hit the mound tonight?
Oh, a ton. I mean, when this guy's pitching, we feel like we have a chance to win, and we believe it, and it's proven that. I mean, we haven't lost yet with him, and he's got an edge to him, too, you know, at a different level where he's a, I think, 13-year big leaguer, and he comes over from the trade. He had to waive his no trade to be a part of this, and that resonates with our players. Like, this dude didn't have to come. He didn't have to say yes to the trade. He was comfortable being a legend in Detroit, but he wanted to be a part of this, and I think that respect – you know, that respect is high for him in that he changed his life in order to help us and help himself be a World Series champion. So he prepares. He's a little different than I expected in terms of being open to change and open to getting better. And there's no diva in him, but there's a huge competitor inside of him that on game day, like, he won't say a word. Like, this is not going to be a real chatty version of Justin Verlander day during games, because he gets locked in, ultra-focused, and comes out with his best fastball in the first inning and doesn't let up.
AJ, it's really interesting what you just said, that he's even more open and changed than you would have expected. We're talking about a Hall of Famer. We're talking about a guy right. Who's accomplished everything in the game except win that world championship. And the Astros have a very definite way of doing things and a very successful way of doing things. What are the types of things maybe that you brought up that you want him to consider that he did?
Really out of pitch. You know, I mean, he's had a good changeup in the past, and he abandoned it during his late years with the Tigers. And when he first got over, that was one of the first things we told him is, you've got a good changeup. It's got action down. Everybody knows about the good carry fastball. Everybody knows about the power breaking ball. But the last dimension is this changeup, and we wanted him to use it a little more. And so, you know, that was more of a longer-term thought, not necessarily a start-by-start thought. And then you look up in the ALCS, and he punches Brett Gardner out on a nasty pitch on one of the most important pitches of Game 6. And we're like, hey, man, we want you to use it. I didn't necessarily mean you had to use it at the most critical moment of Game 6 to right. Try to get out of the inning. But that's how he rolls. I mean, if he finds something that can make him better or gives him a little bit of an edge, he goes full throttle.
You know, before I let you go, and I really appreciate your time today, but it's no secret that you and Dave Roberts are very good friends. In fact, back at the All-Star break, the two of you had lunch in Del Mar, and you were talking about the second half of the season and how it might play out. I'm curious, what was the conversation like, and then what's it like a few months from then, you facing him in the World Series?
Yeah, it's weird. It's weird. I mean, it's surreal because of the conversation we had in Del Mar. They had just passed us for the best record in baseball, but we were clearly the two best teams in baseball at the time in July. And so the trash talk was real. I mean, it was fun, and the banter was there. Both of our wives and kids were there. And it was just more fun and dream scenario. Oh, man, wouldn't it be awesome if we could meet in the World Series? And then as July hit August, and then August hit September, and the congratulatory text started coming in, it became more and more real. So, I mean, obviously, first-time manager in the World Series, that has its own emotions. To do it across the field from one of my closest friends in the game is extra special, and we know one of us is going to be thrilled and one of us is probably going to be crying, but we won't lose perspective in the moment that we're doing this among great people, and you know, I'm happy for the leader he's become, but let's be clear, I want him to win. I want him to lose four games.
AJ Hinch, my guest. All right, so what's the rest of the day look like? I mean, is this a normal in-day, game-day routine, or do you have to change up a little bit because you are in the World Series?
Yeah. Change up a little bit. I mean, the media is a little bit different now with some of the people that cover our games, and they have a press conference room. So I'll do a couple hours worth of media before we go out on the field and work out. And what's cool about, you and I have been to the Super Bowl together. You go to the NBA Finals, NHL Finals are probably the same. The baseball, we do it every single day for over the course of 7 to 10 days. And it's a real event. And baseball games don't often feel like big events until you get to the World Series. And the warning track's filled with media. The stages are down left field line and right field line for various outlets. And the press conference room is packed with reporters. I mean, it does make you feel like you are the most important game of the day. And it should be because you're in the World Series.
Ron Gardenhire is my guest. Ron, it is so good to have you back. How are you, Ron?
Hey, thanks. I appreciate it. Yeah, kind of exciting. Got to meet a lot of nice people up in Detroit. And, Al's been fantastic. And now we're putting the staff together. So it's nice to be back managing in a great organization like Detroit.
You know, Ron, I would imagine, I know for Twins fans, it's going to feel a little bit strange to see you in Tigers gear. How does it feel to you? And did it feel a little bit weird at first?
Yeah, you know what? Last year, going out in Arizona and, being a part of that was a great experience, and put myself in a different uniform, and that was a different feeling for sure, especially going to Minnesota and play there, being in the visiting dugout and looking across at that dugout that I'd been in so long and then getting our brains beat out. I'd seen that happen from Twins teams before, too, to other people. So, that was weird, but this is a little different. Now I've been in Arizona, so I had a different uniform on. This Central Division I know very well. I've played against the Tigers for a long, long time. It will always be strange going into Minnesota and playing against the Twins, but other than that, it's an exciting time here. I'm really proud to say I'm the manager of these guys. It's going to be a lot of fun.
Tigers manager Ron Gardenhire joining us. You mentioned Arizona, which I'm going to ask you about in a minute, but you're going to take over a team that's coming off a rough season, and it's most likely going to be a pretty young team next season. So how do you go about approaching that challenge?
Unfortunately, in Minnesota, we dealt with that, losing players to free agency and all those things with our market, and I had plenty of opportunities to deal with young players and go on. And I think the greatest thing, that you can do in the game is teach. And we're trying to put together a staff here that can do those things. And we've got a few veterans around there that, are going to help the cause. Cabrera and Kinsler and guys like that. And Martinez, let me tell you, these guys have been there and done it. We're going to ask them to kind of help us out and make sure, they kind of police the players along with us. But teaching is the way to go. I've always loved doing that. And young players, it's really fun to watch them, go through the ups and downs and succeed. And that's what we're going to look for.
Detroit Tigers manager Ron Gardenhire, my guest. One of the topics, Ron, that came up at the press conference was the use of analytics. And you said, quote, "Everybody changes," before adding, "I feel like Rocky." So how would you describe your relationship with analytics and getting the right balance between old school and new school?
Yeah, and I actually really enjoyed my time in Arizona. We were definitely involved in that, and I got to see it and hand it to me, and I got to sit in on the reports and going through pitch plans and, spin rates and all those things, and it was really, a different part of the game that we hadn't done much in Minnesota, so it was an eye-opener, and it was a lot of fun. I saw how it really works. It's just more information put in different ways, but it's really good stuff, and percentages and all those things, but the bottom line is, we all know this, you still have to rely on the players and their instincts. You can't ever take their instincts away playing the game and getting a feel for it. You don't want robots. And good players, help those analytics out. And, that's kind of what we talked about. But I'm definitely into it. It's like I said, it was an eye-opener out there, and I learned a lot from Torrey and the staff out there and being involved in the meeting. So it's good stuff, and it's definitely relevant.
We're talking to Ron Gardenhire. On that topic, you were part of Torrey Lovello's staff in Arizona this year. You guys turned a 69-93 team into a 93-69 team and a spot in the postseason. How did you go about doing that, and what was your biggest takeaway from that experience?
Well, it brought in a great atmosphere with Torrey, Mike Hazen, and his staff. Let me tell you what, the atmosphere from day one in spring training was really upbeat and positive, and like I said, going different routes, the communication was unbelievable, and you could just sense it. You could feel it in spring training that these guys, when we were doing our work out there, we were doing all kinds of things, working on shifts, doing drills that I hadn't seen too many of. And you could just feel the vibe in spring training. These guys were having a ball. We brought in some nice little, nice players to compliment the big boys. It was really enjoyable for me. Torrey was a fantastic communicator and a manager, and I got to sit there and I just told him not to knock me off the surfboard because I rode right behind him and just rode the waves.
Ron, you and I had so many conversations when you were the manager of the Twins, and we've talked for a long, long time, so I know that you're never going to make this about you. But before the season, you had a physical, and one of the screenings showed elevated PSA levels, and the follow-up and biopsy revealed that you had prostate cancer. And that's never anything that anybody's ever prepared to hear. What was your reaction when you received that news?
Yeah, it was a big word. You know, I'd talk to the doctors. We're fortunate in baseball that we get, you know, our physical every year, and get your blood checked, and then they do the test. So, you know, lucky for me, found it early, but that's a big word. And I get a call as I'm driving towards spring training, towards Oklahoma, going to Arizona for spring training, that, you know, I definitely have prostate cancer. They found it, and I was ready to turn around and go back and say, let's do the surgery and let's get it out of me. But, you know, from all the biopsies and all these things, you had to wait a couple of months to get it done. So spring training was wonderful. That was a shocker. But like I said, we're blessed in baseball that we get this done every year. They do physicals, and we found it early. So I recommend that to everybody out there, man. Go get physicals, get that blood work, and get it checked out, especially after you're 40 years old.
You know what a great point, too? I would imagine that when you find something like that out, you're saying, let's do this thing right now. Let's get this thing out of the body. And you were not able to do it, as you point out. But then what was it like? Like, Torrey Lovello was talking about how you were out there on the field, like you were 35 again, chasing balls, doing what you'd always done. How valuable was it then to be out there and do baseball things and come to the park every single day while you waited for that surgery?
Yeah, you know, I was ready, and you're right, I was ready to turn around. I told you that, but I got out there, and the doctors here, really in Minnesota, told me, you know, you go do your thing out there. You need your mind off this. Don't worry about this. We're going to take care of it. It's not going anywhere, and, you know, we're going to set up a schedule, and we'll go do it. So it was wonderful. I got out there on the field. Torrey and them kind of let me have my reign. I'd go pick a field out and shag in the outfield and run all over and meet the players and talk to them. And you know what? It was really refreshing. And, like, you know, just like the doctor said, you'll get your mind off this thing. And, you know, thank God for the Arizona Diamondbacks. You know, they were behind me 100%, backed me and said, we got your back. We'll do whatever we have to do for you. And when you get well and get done with this surgery, we'll be right back on the field. So they really took care of me.
They are such a great organization, too, the Diamondbacks. Ron, one more thing. Yep. Let me ask you about the other Torrey. Torrey Hunter said this of you, quote, love the guy. He's definitely a man of experience and managed in some meaningful games. He is a good friend of mine, also someone that raised me in the game of baseball. I am truly happy for him. Torrey Hunter said that about you. You know, as you might recall, this is a big, big Torrey Hunter house. What was it like to manage and work with Torrey Hunter?
Well, I think we all know that, you know, the smile, the intensity, the love of the game, it just all showed every day with Torrey out on the field, and not to mention how great of an athlete he was and a great of a player. And, you know, he just got better and better. He really studied the game and paid attention and talked to a lot of people, and he went from not knowing what the heck that little dot was on a baseball that was coming in, and I had to tell him it was a slider, to actually telling guys, you know, what, seeing what a pitcher's doing and picking up things that you can maybe tell what pitch he's going to throw. So he went full circle, and you know what, I called him just yesterday, matter of fact, and talked to him a little bit, and I offered him a job, any job. I said, if you want to work for me, let's go. And he says, my wife would kick his butt, so he didn't take it, but I was ready.
You just got to keep asking. I'd ask him again when you get the opportunity. Oh, Ron Gardenhire, manager of the year in 2010. He led the Twins to 6 AL Central titles, and now the Tigers have a new manager. Guardy, it's great to have you back. I'm really happy for you. Congratulations. Now we'll look forward to having a conversation with you again next season when the year starts. Great to have you back, Ron.
I appreciate you, Jim. It's always nice talking to you and good hearing your voice again. I kind of miss that thing.
And then this tweet gets me into the next take. What's your take on Juju shutting down Mia Khalifa? He shut her down better than Pat Beverly shut down Lonzo Ball. All right, let's talk about that for a minute. There's a lot inside of that take. You should stop whatever you're doing. Literally, stop whatever you're doing. And follow Juju Smith-Schuster on Twitter right now. Because that game of hide-and-seek that he played on Sunday in the end zone after his house call, while the best celebration of the NFL season, it's still only about one-tenth as entertaining as what's playing out on his Twitter feed right now. All right, so know this. Juju is 20. He does not have a driver's license. He's part of that proud Long Beach Poly fam. He doesn't have a driver's license, at least not yet, and he rides a pedal whip to practice every single day. So that's true. Juju Smith-Schuster, a professional football player for the Steelers, presumably with millions in the bank, pedals to work. Hey, listen, my man loves his bike. He lives near the facility. He's into it. I respect that. I'm actually Team Bike, not on the road, but I'm a member of Bike Nation. I mentioned I've got a Peloton, which I love. I use all the time. And this is why the video that he posted yesterday around noon was both devastating and heartbreaking.
Man, somebody stole my bike. I ain't got a bike no more. I'm walking towards practice. This is crazy.
All right, so he's walking towards practice. He dropped that video while walking. Man, somebody stole my bike. I don't have a bike no more. This is crazy. I mean, God, I hate to hear that. So, after he realized that his two-wheeler had been lifted, he posted a picture of him and the bike, and he said, quote, "I hope it's not the end of an era. Hashtag team find Juju's bike." And he chased that with another great tweet that just read mood with a crying emoji, a broken heart emoji, and the track "Best I Ever Had" by Drake. So at this point, this thing takes off. Then team find Juju's bike rolls into action, immobilizes. Because then his dude, Antonio Brown, jumped in and he tried to help out. Hell, even Bryce Harper jumped in. Both of them hashtagged team find Juju's bike. And then fans were all over it too. That's when our pal and the director of communications for the Pittsburgh Steelers, Bert Lauten, decided to jump in front of this viral story. Bert tweeted from his own personal account, quote, "For all the newsroom people out there, please do not text, call, tweet, or DM me for a comment on a missing bike. Though I hope he finds it, I also have bigger fish to fry. Thank you." In other words, straight public relations fire. That's savage right there. Nice job, Bert. And clearly everybody knew that he was joking because the first comment on that tweet was from Steelers DN Cam Hayward, who wrote back, "Hey, Bert, you got that bike Juju was looking for?" So with practice wrapping up, Juju was back on Twitter. And then things got depressing again for a second when he thumbed out, "Gotta walk home now." Now, this is when it gets really, really good. And this is what the other tweeter was thumbing out his tweet about to me. And I'm just going to say it. Juju's bike getting lifted was worth it for what happened next. Because while Juju was getting all this attention, guess who decided to show up to the party? I'll give you a hint. She's got a bit of a track record of getting mixed up with athletes on Twitter pretty regularly. And usually she's on the right side of it. Usually she's the one who gets over. Usually she gets the better of it. That's right. None other than Mia Khalifa. Mia Khalifa is an adult film actress with nearly 2 million followers on Twitter. That's a huge number. So she got in the middle of this whole thing. Because why the hell not? And let me tell you right now, Mia probably wishes she never got involved. Check this out. In response to everything that Juju was tweeting, Mia thumbed out, quote, "You are my new favorite follow on Twitter, Juju." Innocent enough, right? Seems like a nice thing to say. She's got this whole network of followers. She's famous. It seems innocent enough, right? Must not have been. Because for as innocent as that sounded, Juju loaded up a nuke and then slammed that little red button. His response, and I quote, "Ah, hell nah. I'm not falling for this. I'm young, not stupid." End of tweet. Shut it down. Let's go home.
Let's go home. It's a wrap.
You know, as only Mia would understand, it'd be like, "Hey, Vivid Video, your girl's wandering around the 50-yard line. Can you come and get her?" It's in reference to what she had said about Wilson Contreras. Hey, remember when Chris Carter told a bunch of rookies that they needed to have a fall guy to stay out of trouble? Not really. All you need is Juju's Twitter game. My man Juju should be the keynote speaker at a rookie symposium going forward. This kid's locked in. And he's not about to join the hit list, which includes Contreras and Chad Kelly, among others. Juju, my man, I am so sorry that your bike got jacked. I really am. But I'm not sorry that it led to a great Twitter rejection. And trust me, if I had my way, I would throw a gold jacket on you right now and enshrine you in the Twitter Hall of Fame. But, here's the best part. All's well that ends well, because according to Lisa Washington of KDKA in the Berg, somebody did return Juju's bike. That makes Juju the first person to ever get the better of Mia Khalifa on Twitter and the first person to ever get a stolen bike back. Team Juju. Team Juju for life. Boy, he had himself out of day, didn't he? My man's got his bike back. And his Twitter game is intact. So, to Tyler Kaplan, that's my take. Just because I've not been talking hockey does not mean I've not been watching hockey, following hockey. I have, of course. I love the NHL. And yes, Bella, I know you love when I talk hockey. And I love the NHL. And I've seen the fast start that Steven Stamkos and Tampa Bay are off to. I've seen the rebound the Kings have made. I've seen the absolute heater Alex Ovechkin has been on since the Caps gassed out in the postseason last year, like I said they would. But I want to turn your attention for a moment to what went down in Philadelphia last night. You had two of the toughest dudes in the NHL drop gloves, square off in the first period. Kevin Bieksa of the Ducks, who you've heard on this show, Radko Gudas of the Flyers, and the Superman punch heard around the world. Look, we know the impact that MMA has had, specifically the UFC and Conor McGregor. Conor McGregor taking on the establishment, cashing that nine-figure check to fight Floyd, the Octagon and UFC changing combat sports forever. But the one thing that I never thought that I would see was a couple of tough guys on the ice ready to throw hands the way they were, and one of them leaving his skates to land a right-hand hammer heard round the entire hockey world.
Now Gudas and Bieksa come out of the penalty box. They're going to go at it in the neutral zone. No punches thrown yet. Oh, Bieksa landed a haymaker. A right hand which knocked Gudas down to the ice. Fight over.
Literally a one-punch fight. One-punch fight. AM 830 with that sound. One punch and one of the toughest dudes in hockey staring at the lights, wondering what hit him. One flying punch to the jaw, and Kevin Bieksa goes absolute legend. 36-year-old defenseman who had been dropping gloves for over a decade, breaking out a new trick to send one of the more hated young pugilists in the game to the bench, wondering what in the hell kind of sledgehammer that was. Look, I've seen a lot of hockey fights, hundreds of hockey fights, I don't know, thousands of hockey fights. I've never seen a dude leave his skates and land a shot like that. Literally a perfect punch in the perfect spot, and this cat was out before he hit the ice. That's a punch that might change hockey fights forever. That's a punch that Bieksa was saving for Gudas. A punch that might have drawn a toothless smile from the entire league when they check it out. And say what you want about fighting in hockey, that it no longer has a place in the game, that it's barbaric, that it accomplishes nothing, that it's outlived its usefulness, that it was never, ever useful to begin with. Maybe so. Maybe so, except the next person who leaves the arena when a fight starts is going to be the first. And on top of that, in last night's game, the Ducks were getting out-hustled, outshot, outplayed, and outscored when the two of these guys squared off. 1-0. And then after Gudas picked himself up off the ice and took a seat on the bench, the Ducks scored 6 times, pouring it on for a 6-2 win. And I'd argue that Bieksa triggered the whole thing. And when he hit him with that one punch, that was like a one-punch Joaquin email. Sincerely, Superman! Look, if you don't like hockey fights, disregard the entire take. But if you do, or you're neutral, do yourself a favor, go watch that fight right now. Just call it up on your phone, call it up on your desktop, call it up on your lapper, because that's something I have never seen in a hockey game or a hockey fight before. Only thing missing from that was the ref waving it off and not even bothering to count Gudas out before reaching for his mouthpiece and calling that fight and having the doctor rush into the ring to see if he was all right. That's how bad that was. That fight was over before he hit the ice. Gary Sheffield is my guest. Gary, it's great to have you back. How are you?
Good. How you doing, buddy?
Good, Chef. I'm doing great. Nice to visit with you. Let me ask you about the Dodgers opening up that series, Gary, with a 3-1 win. It included leading off the bottom of the first with a first-pitch home run. What did you make of how the Dodgers handled the pressure of Game 1?
Well, you know, I've been saying it all along, how David Robinson, you know, he got a three-way lineup. You know, he got guys leading off that has power and hit for average. And he has his big thumpers, middle order guys hitting second and third. And then he starts it over with Yasiel Puig. And normally Yasiel Puig hits seventh, but they got him hitting fourth and fifth sometimes. So each time you think you get through a certain amount of hitters, then you got three more coming up that's giving you tough at-bats, and which was it puts a lot of stress on pitchers. And as you see, you know, they got to the bullpen and they was able to chip away with, you know, two more, you know, when he got a little tired.
Gary Sheffield joining us. You know, Gary, you talk about the big thumpers. Justin Turner homered last night, and he continued his absolutely huge postseason. You and the TBS crew have taken to calling him Little Chef. I mean, what is it about this guy, right? I mean, the Mets gave up on him. You look at him, and it doesn't seem like he would do anything spectacular, and the guy's just a freak, especially in the postseason. What do you make of the way he has shown up in the playoffs, and how do you explain it?
Well, you know, you guys change their swing, and sometimes it takes them longer than others. And just like Jorge Bautista, you know, he had the same type of situation where he couldn't pull the baseball. And he had came to me, and I told him, you gotta get start using your top hand and being on time. All hitting is being on time. And when you're on time, you can pull the baseball and, as well as elevate it. And I think he reinvented his swing, and now he's becoming a star.
We're talking to Gary Sheffield. He was the 1992 National League batting champ. You know, at the same time, Gary, when you look at the Astros, is there a part of you that's thinking, we just faced, if you're the Astros, we just faced their ace. We were a swing or two away from getting the win. So is there a reason to be confident, especially when they've got their ace, Justin Verlander, going tonight?
Well, you know, they have a team where they got Carlos Beltran on there. He's a veteran guy, and he knows it's just one win, a win that they were supposed to win at home. And they know that if just by having a great pitching outing by Justin Verlander, they put up a few runs and steal a game here, they right back in the series. And by no means they're panicking at this point. They feel like, you know, it's a seven-game series, but you don't want to go down 2-0.
All right, so what's it like when you've got a guy like Verlander, when he came to them? I mean, he's been absolutely dominant in the postseason. What's that mean to the rest of the team? What's it feel like when you take the field, when you've got that big dog on the bump and you really expect to win?
Well, they feel like anytime you can trade for a guy like Justin Verlander, it's a sense of relief for the everyday players. You know, they know that we have the offense and we're number one offense in the league, and if we can get that one extra pitcher to go with our ace, it's just going to take us over the hump in a short game series. And these guys are truly believing that they can win. And if you look at yesterday's game, It was all about home runs, you know, you guys. But unfortunately, Dodgers got a guy on and got two out of it. But it was just a solo home run game, and they was in the game. They just, you know, Kershaw was just lights out. You have to tip your cap to him. But coming into this game, Justin, you know, they expect him to go out and pitch a great game, and they're going to do play like business as usual.
Gary Sheffield joins us for a few more moments. So having watched the Dodgers throughout the postseason, what do you think is the key to beating them? What's their weakness as you see it?
Well, you know, really they don't have too many weaknesses. The key to beating them is you got to move runners. You can't think you're going to get two, three hits, four hits, and inning just to score a couple of runs and or think about the long ball. You have to play small ball. You know, you got to hit behind runners and things like that. You know, they're a good defensive ball club. They well pitch, especially their bullpen. They're lights out. So you have to just keep the pressure on them and then get up by a few runs and play crisp baseball.
Gary Sheffield, my guest. You know, I had Sean Casey on the show yesterday, Gary. We talked about the fact that even though he never won a World Series, he cherished the fact that he got to play in one and test himself on the biggest stage. When you look back on it, what do you remember about that experience of playing in the World Series?
How the intensity goes up, you know, the intensity level of mistakes. If you make a mistake, it can cost you a game. And so you want to play perfect baseball, especially as a defender, and you want to get timely hitting, because anytime you leave runners in scoring position, it comes back to haunt you, because you know, runs come at a premium.
Gary, I hate to age myself, but I'm old enough that I remember. I remember when you came up. When you came up as a 19-year-old shortstop. Now, what was that first season like? I mean, it's hard to imagine, hard to fathom. As a 19-year-old, you were playing in the major leagues. What do you remember about that first year?
Well, just the fact that I was playing on the same field with Robin Yount and Paul Molitor, and then I saw Kirby Puckett and Dave Stewart and Ricky Henderson. And when you start looking at these guys, and you get, once you get over the shock of I'm playing with these guys, you know, you go back to playing the way you play, and you realize I made it, and it's just a you know, it's just a starstruck type situation, and it's hard to explain, because when you just at shortstop and Ricky Henderson coming, you know, bearing down on you on a stolen base, it becomes real quick.
Like Gary, you mentioned so many classic guys right there. I could pick any one of those guys. Have you got a favorite Ricky story that you can tell on this show? Everybody's got one. Some that you can tell, some that you can't tell. What's your favorite Ricky story?
Well, the favorite Ricky story, you know, he showed me a fan mail one time, and a bunch of women started calling in, telling him to wear those loose shorts. They could see his legs.
That's
because he used to wear his pants so tight.
That sounds like Ricky. What about Kirby Puckett? God, he was amazing, right? What kind of a guy? What was he like as a guy and as a competitor?
Well, Kirby Puckett was like a big brother. You know, he was always helping you on the other end. You know, telling you what to expect and how to go about being a professional and playing the game the right way. And people respect that, and people understand guys that play hard and play to win and not be selfish. And hearing that from an opponent, you know, that was a special guy.
You mentioned Dave Stewart. How fierce was Stu when he was on the bump?
Well, nobody wanted to step in the box on Stu, you know, because you could see his eyes. He had the hat pulled down, and he was throwing that blazing fastball with the forkball, and he'll buzz your tower at the same time. So you never want to get on his bad side.
Gary, before I let you go, I got to ask you, it seems like from the outside looking at you, you've settled into your role as an analyst really very easily. I know the folks there love you. I'm curious what it's like to work with Pedro every single day. I mean, you were competitive as hell when you played, which meant that to some extent that you were not going to wear your uniform. If somebody didn't wear the same uniform as you, they were not going to be your friend. So what did you think of Pedro when you played against him, and then what's it like when you first started to work with him?
Well, I didn't like him when I first met him, you know, and played against him. You know, I didn't like him at all. But by getting to know him now, he would have been the perfect teammate for me. Pedro brought a side out of me that I didn't know I had. You know, I'm more of a serious person, and he's brought that lighter side out of me. And now I have more fun with those guys. But at the same time, when he goes off cue with some crazy answers, then I have to bring it back to reality.
Thanks so much for listening to the Daily Jungle and to the Jim Rome podcast. Episode 10 did drop yesterday, and the reaction has been amazing. Make sure you check it out with Chris Archer. If you haven't done so already, keep on trusting the podcast. See you next time. I'm out.